General Motors is worthless. Stores in the malls are closing even before Christmas. American Express needs a credit card from Uncle Sam just to survive. It looks bad. And who better to help us out than Dmitry Orlov, author of Reinventing Collapse, The Soviet Example, and American Prospects. Dmitry, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. Great to be with you.
You know, our last interview was picked up by at least 40 radio stations. Here's my big question for you this time. Dmitry, what the hell is happening to us?
Well, we are in the final stages of financial collapse, and we are in the early stages of commercial collapse. We still have this idea that that we might be able to bail out various parts of the commercial sector, and we still have the idea that the government is capable of doing something, and that one of these things is spending money. Now, it turns out that the government actually doesn't have any money, and as a lender of last resort, what is being sacrificed is the solvency of the U.S. government. And I would think that on a fairly short timeline, perhaps a year, perhaps two, it will become apparent that the U.S. government is insolvent.
Wow. I visited your blog at cluborlov.blogspot.com, and I saw you just spoke along with John Michael Greer at the 5th Annual Community Solutions Conference. What was that conference about?
The conference was mostly about things that people could do, adjustments that they could make to their lives. Some of it was very common sense stuff, such as, you know, super insulating your house to be able to afford the heating bills. Some of it was about alternative forms of transportation. I talked about sailing, making use of sailing vessels that we have on hand to make up for the coming shortages of diesel fuel, which will make trucking very expensive and sometimes impossible. There were some efforts in the direction of putting together smart jitney programs so that people don't have to drive, you know. We can quadruple or even quintuple the efficiency of the cars that exist today just by making sure that there's full occupancy, that there are no free seats in any of the cars on the road when they're moving. So those are all fairly common sense, small, perhaps, you know, shy moves in the right direction. And I hope that, you know, people take that sort of thing seriously, because it makes sense to go through things like that, even if it's just a training exercise.
Last January, you explained that there were five stages of collapse, and would it bore you too much to explain it again to our listeners? Because I think we really need to hear it now.
Yes, well, the five stages is what I talked about in my keynote address at the conference. The stage that we are in the final part of now is financial collapse. Basically, the assumptions of endless economic growth and the assumptions that money will be worth something, that we can conserve value by investing it in productive capacity of some sort, that all of that is being negated as we speak. Right now, there is still this idea that there might be bailouts for for American Express, for credit card companies. A lot of that comes down to basically canceling debts. You know, debt forgiveness is what I advocated to start with. If everybody, you know, realized that these debts are unrepayable no matter what anyone does, it would have been possible to unwind the debt pyramid without incurring these crippling liabilities on behalf of the United States government. But that's really what's happening. We have now, you know, extra few trillion dollars of unrepayable government public debt. So that's the first stage. And the second stage is what we're beginning to see, which is commercial collapse, basically deliveries failing to happen and retail outlets closing, people losing access so that even if they have money, they can't spend it. Because there's nowhere to spend it. They, you know, at some point it will become very difficult to get deliveries of any sort to take place. So everything will start to be based on existing inventory and things that can be scavenged in the immediate vicinity. And on the heels of that, we'll probably have political collapse because what will happen is, you know, government in the United States is very dependent on finance. It can't really get very much done without access to money, without borrowing. In some states, notably in California, there's a stopgap borrowing between when they spend the money and when they get taxes in, that if it doesn't take place, suddenly their budgets evaporate and absolutely essential things like garbage removal, for instance, will fail to take place. Of course, what is already happening is bridges and roads and various other pieces of infrastructure are beyond what can be maintained given the new fiscal realities. So we're going to have a lot of impassable roads. A lot of smaller population centers might end up cut off and might require long detours to get to. So those are all things that are off in the distance. But right now there's a lot of hope that the government can make a difference for the better. And, you know, some of that may be realistic, but I don't think that the financial levers of control are actually attached to anything on the other end anymore. So it's more a question of gesturing than of actually impacting what is happening.
You know, unfortunately, I agree with you. These days, it feels like that sort of phony war they had in 1939. The war had been declared, but there was no fighting for almost a year. Well, you know, now our commercial system appears to be collapsing, but the malls are still full of gear. It's surreal. But I'm hearing the shipping is more or less stopped, you know, and even in American ports and the Greek lines going bust. And that means a lag time of several months to a year before some of these imported products start to disappear off the shelves, although it's already happening now in Iceland, I'm told. Do you think it's worth trying to prepare ourselves personally by stocking up on food and supplies?
Well, yes and no. I think it makes sense to have a few months' worth of supply, although it doesn't provide for fresh food, which is absolutely essential. You can, of course, you know, do simple things like sprout beans, for instance, to ward off scurvy. But you know, canned and frozen food is a mixed blessing at best. It can be used to basically ride out the immediate aftermath of commercial collapse, because with it comes a lot of anger, you know, hoarding and looting. You know, the looting is sort of an antidote to hoarding, and hoarding is what happens when, you know, a market economy runs out of, you know, key commodities. So it's best to not have to participate. And if you have, you know, some resources of your own, not a huge hoard, but enough to survive, then it may make it possible to spare yourself a lot of unpleasantness. Now, after that period, I think it will become very, very important for people to figure out ways to gain access to food, and it could be any number of things. I know the things that I would naturally do, which is like pick mushrooms, because, you know, this is something that I can do because most people I know can't tell a poisonous mushroom from a non-poisonous mushroom. I can. So the forests are mine, you know. Mine and, you know, the other Russians, of course, will be there in hordes doing the same thing because they all are competent mushroom pickers. But, you know, that's a resource that I can make use of. Other people can do similar things. Other people can fish, for instance. Or they know a little bit about aquaculture and can stock a fish pond, or they're competent gardeners and they can spend a summer out in the countryside somewhere, you know, pay a little bit to some farmer, maybe sharecrop even. You know, once the tractors stop moving, a lot of farmers will have nothing better to do with their very large fields than to basically invite people to come and, you know, visit during the summer and try to grow something. That seems like a reasonable plan. So people will have to start doing things like that, because it's really about the flow of food. It's not about inventory. A stockpile of food is by definition rotten, you know, and not very healthy. So I think that's what people should start thinking about.
Yeah, like where does food come from and how can we participate in it? Are you surprised at how quickly things are unraveling? Are there events we should watch for, warning signs, so to speak?
Yeah, surprised, disappointed. I mean, I don't get any special satisfaction from being wrecked. You know, I predicted these things basically by refusing to believe the fiction that everybody insisted was real. Because once you basically dismiss the idea that, oh, it looks solid, therefore it is solid, you actually start looking at what it is fundamentally, how sound it is, you basically start to see which way it's heading. And it's surprising how quickly it's headed in that direction. The other thing is that, you know, being able to predict these things and see this unraveling slightly ahead of time doesn't do me any good necessarily. I mean, you know, maybe there's an element of psychological preparation. I've said that before. You know, that's helpful. It's better than being taken by surprise. But very few people are really capable of, really preparing the way they should. Because they're very hemmed in by the current living arrangement, and they're surrounded by people who are full of unrealistic expectations, and they have to abide by rules that are maladaptive to the future that is ready to arrive. So people are very limited in the sorts of things that, you know, they can do. I mean, if you live in a suburban neighborhood and you start putting up, you know, little windmills that are composed of pieces of SUVs, because, you know, the SUVs aren't very useful anymore, and start collecting rainwater and start plowing up your lawn and planting, squash and corn and beans and things, your local property owners association will write you a big ticket for it. You will be fined. That's very typical. And it will take a while before the property owners associations are extinct, you know. And by that time, it will be too late to start doing these things. So this is all very unfortunate.
Yes, our social arrangements will slow us down. Well, we're talking with Dmitry Orlov, and one of your prescriptions for salvaging what's left in America is to close the foreign bases, just bring the troops home. And that sounded outrageous last spring, and it seems rather obvious now. I just heard the big financier Jim Rogers say the very same thing on CNBC TV this week. Isn't it strange how ideas that seem repellent suddenly morph to become the new public dialogue? Everybody accepts it.
Well, to me it looks like, you know, my ideas look repellent to people I find repellent, and then at some point those people shut up and I'm gratified. That's the evolution as it seems to me. It's not an evolution of ideas. It's sort of a de-evolution of a certain segment of humanity. But the idea of bringing troops home is a very obvious one. You know, right now the military is not doing anything of any particular use around the world. There's 1,000 military bases, but if they go away, it's not clear that anything around the world would change particularly. If they were brought back, the army could basically be reformed in a way that would allow it to play a positive role. The problem is that Americans need to be defended from each other at all times. They pose a greater danger to each other than most other nations. This is currently done by the police and through the outrageously high prison population, because of all the unsolved social problems that have been swept under the rug for decades, sometimes for hundreds of years. And so the problem with police is that police safeguard property, because their income and their budgets are based on tax receipts. So that, for instance, Beverly Hills is very well defended, and, you know, eastern Los Angeles much less so. You know, that's a typical example. The problem is that when municipal budgets more or less go away. The police become much less eager to defend people from each other and much more eager to defend themselves and their own families and look out for their own interests. So I think that the U.S. military has a big role to play in domestic peacekeeping. I think that all of these troops that are repatriated will need to be placed in various urban areas to keep the peace. And the other thing that can be done very usefully with the military is that, you know, the military is a unique organization because they just follow orders. You don't necessarily need a big budget. You don't need a recruitment arm if the people are already there. So you can basically tell them to do things like grow potatoes, like truck in dirt from the suburbs and nail together boxes in parking lots in inner cities for raised bed agriculture, like drag jersey barriers into place to block off raised highways and use them instead to put together water collection systems because there won't be any traffic anyway. All of these things can be done very efficiently and quickly by the military. And when nothing is moving because the wheels of commerce and finance are stuck in mud, the military can be the only thing that, you know, the President of the United States, federal authorities, and state authorities can call on to actually get useful things accomplished. Right now, of course, there is this ridiculously huge defense budget, but if you look at it, a lot of that gets wasted on various types of military tools, basically new ways of blowing things up, and then on mobility, mid-air refueling, transportation, long supply lines, you know, delivering three flavors of ice cream to an air-conditioned tent in the middle of the desert somewhere, all of that sort of thing. Now, that is all an essential because the soldiers can move around on the double or on bicycles. They don't actually need any form of transportation other than boots. If it's not across the world that they have to travel, but to the next county by sometime next week, you know, that's perfectly reasonable. So I think that, you know, the U.S. military is a useful resource that is right now being basically being squandered on absolutely useless foreign involvement, but can be pulled back and can be used to make life possible for people in the United States where it wouldn't be otherwise.
Well, Dmitry, I'd like to get your take on a debate running in the blogosphere these days. James Howard Kunstler and Max Kaiser are among many who expect a period of deflation, you know, where prices fall, and then a wild bout of inflation where a hamburger could end up costing $1,000, say. And they call it the tsunami dollar. It goes out and then it rushes back in. Do you expect inflation, or might America just go bankrupt?
I'm familiar with the tsunami metaphor, that first money goes out and there's a drop in asset prices, and then money rushes in as it's being printed because, you know, the debt has to be monetized because it can no longer be rolled over. And it makes a lot of sense to me. I think that there's a wider perspective that would be more useful, which is that money as a metaphor becomes not so useful because it's denominated in economic growth, which is dependent on fossil fuels, which are dwindling. So if you have a dollar that's denominated in oil, you know, and an individual can very easily afford to use something that produces 100 horsepower for hours a day, right, which is the situation now, and suddenly they go to a situation where it's just them, and working flat out, they're putting out something like 0.2 horsepower, and they have to actually grow food and eat the food in order to even do that, then, you know, the value of the money is just not the same. And it doesn't even matter how much of it you have. It's just that everybody's poor no matter how you slice it. So the other perspective that people should have on money is, you know, there's a Russian saying, money doesn't smell. It doesn't matter where you got your money. You know, it still looks the same, and it still works the same. So you could make your money by, you know, painting paintings, or you could make your money by, you know, slaughtering dolphins, and it would still be the same money. So in general, this is a real problem that money doesn't smell. And my feeling is that if we could actually smell our money, we would be repulsed by it and would refuse to go near it. And there's a complete disconnect where, you know, people realize that the whole economic development program is in a very wrong path, you know, that we're destroying the planet, we're destroying ourselves, we're destroying society, that the whole thing is unsustainable and in crisis. And yet we're looking for ways to get a return on our investment, you know, and what we're investing in is more of the same destruction, okay? So not only do we not want to stop this destruction by pulling money out of circulation, by refusing to invest, but we want the destruction to proceed faster and faster. And I think people should stop and think about it, and there are things you can do with your money. Basically, you can refuse to invest in this economy. You can, for instance, lend it to somebody, but lend it at 0% interest. You know, the Muslim banking system. You know, and that's a step in the right direction. But the whole idea of how can we safeguard our wealth? How can we get the greatest return on investment? I think that's just a flawed approach altogether.
Really, I mean, the planet can't take the kind of growth that we've been giving it. We've run out of planet space, and we're damaging the climate as well. Well, I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock, and you've been listening to a chat with Dmitry Orlov. I do recommend everyone get his book, Reinventing Collapse, The Soviet Example and American Prospects. It will help orient you to these confusing times and give some helpful suggestions on how we can adapt. So, Dmitry, it's always a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Alex.
Find out more about our guest at cluborlov.blogspot.com and do get his book while you still can.